Thank you very much for turning up on the morning session of the last day of a long conference. It's really nice to see everyone here. And I'm hoping this talk will... Oh, before I go any further, I'd better just do the... I haven't got any financial or other conflicts of interest to declare. As the introduction, thank you very much for that introduction said, I'm from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, where we have a small transport and health research group. And one of the things that we advocate for is, not surprisingly, trying to include the public health gains, risks and benefits of transport interventions to be included in evaluations. Partly because when you start certainly economically valuing some of the health gains, you get quite a different answer about whether transport interventions are a good thing or not. Now, one of the uncomfortable truths, I guess, that we don't often acknowledge in public health is, of course, that there aren't any such thing as unalloyed gains. Almost everything we do has gains and losses across the range of health and well-being outcomes, and gains and losses often for different parts of the population. If I just give examples from transport systems, because that is my area, if we're thinking about what a healthy transport system has to do, we might want health gains across a range of things that might include reducing injury, enhancing social inclusion, fostering access to the determinants of health, and encouraging active travel, as we just heard from Alison's very nice talk. We might also want that transport system to foster equity in some ways, or at least not further widen inequalities in health. So those are a range of very different outcomes. And I think one thing that public health researchers certainly often under-acknowledge is that our interventions end up often trading those off against one another rather than getting win-wins in all areas. And if I just start with the obvious example, which is, as we've just heard, these are data from the UK, but they could be from almost any other high-income country. Injury rates have dramatically declined in almost all high-income countries, if we're looking at children's road injury rates. But that's been accompanied, as we've heard, by a real decline in what we might call active transport, just looking at the period where that kind of, Alison mentioned, from the 1960s, but that kind of decline carried on, a decline in children walking and cycling, and a consequent rise in the number of them being inside a car, where they're safer, they're not being run over as pedestrians, but with obviously huge costs in terms of health, in terms of physical activity and social inclusion. Our cities, and I speak from London, and I think many cities in this country are very similar, our cities are now very inhospitable to young people. There are very few bits of public space where they are welcome. They're kind of shut out of the malls, who don't want any loitering. Parents are too worried to let them walk or cycle to parks. And on their own in the street, they get told off for playing in the street, the streets are too dangerous. There's very little public space that young people can access. So we've made the streets safer, but we've done that at quite a cost. And that's one example. The second example, of these trade-offs I want to mention, is that those huge gains in road safety for young people have certainly not been matched by any gains in equity. In fact, the evidence in many countries is that inequalities in road injury are actually widening as we're making roads safer. We're doing absolutely nothing for inequalities. And there's something I still find quite shocking, and again, these data are from England and Wales this time, but could be from almost any other high-income country. The inequalities, and middle and low-income countries in this one, the inequalities in terms of deprivation are still quite stark. This is child pedestrian injury, and a 2.5 to 3 times higher risk if you're unlucky enough to be born in the poorer neighbourhoods of being seriously injured on the roads. So there are some trade-offs, but this is supposed to be a good news presentation. What I wanted to do this morning was just try and think through those interventions, those transport interventions that do have a win-win, that manage to achieve health gain across one or more outcomes without damaging health in terms of other outcomes, and get some kind of gain in terms of equity. And I was thinking it might be useful to have a little look at what does get a win-win, to see if we can think through some of the common factors and start identifying what kinds of transport system interventions are more likely to achieve health gain without the costs in other areas. So what I want to do this morning is just take, and this is going to be almost subliminally going through some research findings, so if you want more information on any of these case studies, please do ask me, but just to flag up three case studies of interventions that I think have had some win-wins, and just to think about what the implications of that are for how we might start researching, evaluating transport intervention, and what implications that has for policy and practice. So my first case study is speed reductions through 20-mile-an-hour zones. 20-mile-an-hour zones are an engineering intervention. There are humps or chicanes built into the road to make traffic slow down, along with a sign at the entrance. And many of them have been added to in rather decorative ways, as you can see, by kids themselves. These zones were, if I just flip to the second slide, in the Greater London area, the London boroughs started implementing these in the late 1970s in large numbers. And the number of residential streets that are now inside 20-mile-an-hour zones has grown hugely. An evaluation we conducted that used a sort of controlled interrupted time series analysis to look at, so we managed to control for the background trend in decline in injury, found quite dramatic reductions in road traffic injury in those 20-mile-an-hour zones. In fact, a 42% decline, with no evidence of any migration to neighbouring roads, which was one of the concerns. Which is good news. That's excellent news. It's also an intervention that seems to have mitigated inequalities in road injury, in part because, as this shows, the interventions were rolled out by local authorities and they prioritised low-income neighbourhoods. This is just split neighbourhoods in London in terms of quintiles of deprivation, with red as the most deprived. And as you can see, the rollout of the programme was faster in more deprived areas. The upshot of that was casualties declined, as you might expect, fastest. Given that the intervention was as effective in every area of deprivation as you might expect, there are no reasons why it wouldn't be as effective in low-income as high-income areas. That decline in injury was greater in more deprived areas, if we just look at the number of casualties predicted to have been saved by those interventions, by just taking away the number that were predicted from the actual number from the predicted ones, we can see that there are a greater number. So it didn't actually pull down inequalities in injury rate, because there was also a trend, as I've suggested, of widening inequalities in terms of area deprivation in England and Wales. But what it did was mitigate that quite significantly. So that's an intervention that seems to have had gains for injury reduction and gains for equity. Let me take my second case study, which is a very, very different kind of intervention in a transport system. This was a scheme to introduce free bus travel to all young people in London. So in the middle of the 1990s, anyone under 16, and then it was extended to under 18-year-olds a year later, was given or could apply for a free bus pass called a zip card, which entitled them to travel not just on school buses, but any bus in the Greater London area for free. And that was given to anyone could apply for that. It wasn't just targeted at low-income young people. Now, that's the kind of scheme that was introduced, not particularly for health, for public health gain, at least not explicitly originally. The intention was to reduce, or at least to remove one cause of social exclusion, that of inability to pay for transport, so to help young people continue studying, employment, But it was also part of a raft of policies by Transport for London, the agency responsible for implementing the Mayor of London's transport policy. A raft of policies that they were rolling out in order to reduce car traffic in the centre of London. So it was part of a raft of policies to encourage us all to use buses, public transit, and to leave the car at home. So other things that that are well known were the introduction of the congestion charge zone, a £10 charge to drive your car into central London. So this was part of a kind of whole raft of measures, which is a challenge, obviously, in terms of evaluation. But it was also part of measures to not just get people to leave their car at home, but to try and persuade people that it was okay to use the bus. Before the investment in public transport, London was like most other cities, where the bus was seen as a mode of last resort, I guess. Our ex-Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher probably apocryphally described any man aged 30 on a bus as a failure, and that perhaps kind of summed up the image of bus transport. But of course, if you do want to reduce the number of private cars in a large city, you have to persuade the majority of people to use a mass transit system like the bus system. So this was also part of the aim of this scheme, was to try and persuade young people that using the bus was a good way to get around. So if I just, again, very briefly skim through the evaluation findings from the scheme, because it was evaluated in terms of not just the explicit aims, but also a raft of public health outcomes that might have been that might have accrued. People were very worried, for instance, it would even further reduce the very small amount of walking and active travel that young people do. If you give them a free bus pass, there's absolutely no incentive then to walk to school or walk to the shops. So our evaluation looked at a whole range of public health outcomes. Just to be very brief, we found that not surprisingly, it did foster independent mobility, not just because kids could get to places, but in the context of what I'd said earlier about public spaces being very much closed down in cities, the bus actually became a site in and of itself of to be social. If you have a free bus pass, you can actually just take, you can take a circular bus tour if you like. You can just sit on the top deck with your friends. And for people who live in very crowded accommodation, that becomes in and of itself a kind of public space to be. You can just sit there for free and chat and do whatever. It also did remove a financial barrier to inclusion. There were absolutely no children or young people in the evaluation who said that they couldn't get to activities, sports activities, social clubs, church, shopping, because of finances. There were still some issues around inclusion, certainly around young people with disabilities, but finance had been removed as a barrier to inclusion. Interestingly, it didn't affect the distances walked. You might think giving a free bus pass reduces the amount of walking you do, but actually what it does is increases the number of trips you take. And actually, because sadly, almost all walking done by young people is either in the context of shopping or using the public transit system, actually encouraging more trips lifted the distance walked. But most interestingly, for my argument today, there was also evidence that it did meet this aim of what you might call destigmatising the public transport system. And that was because it was offered to all young people. And what young people really want to do is travel with their friends. That's the kind of first aim of any trip, is to kind of do it with your friends if you can. So what they do is have quite convoluted routes sometimes to school that involved kind of picking up people on the route, either near bus stops or taking quite complicated bus routes in order to get to school, because it included everybody. That did reduce, at least in outer London, the number of car journeys taken. Kids didn't want to get lifts from their parents, because what you can do, if everyone has a bus pass, is include everybody in that journey. And there was some evidence that even though the older young people we talked to were still saying, yeah, can't wait to get my driving licence, can't wait to drive, there was also a sense in that But of course, you wouldn't drive to go out in London. You'd get the bus, or you wouldn't drive, you know, if you were going into town late, you'd take the bus. So there was some evidence that bus transport had been destigmatised. It had become a mode on a par with other modes of transport. 5 minutes. Okay, very, very quickly then, the third case study I wanted to take was cycling in London, just to take another active mode and look at adults for a moment. Very few journeys are taken by bike in London. It's around 3%. But of those 3% of trips, if I can be crude about it, the cyclists are disproportionately rich white men. The more affluent, very few minority ethnic groups cycle, and women are disproportionately less likely to cycle. A small qualitative study unpacked that a little bit, and unpacked particularly how risk acts as a deterrent for women and some minority ethnic groups. It's not that, because cycling is risky for both genders, and there are many other cities in the world where women cycle more than men do, so it's not a kind of objective risk that's the problem. It's the meaning of that risk and how you handle it. And it had meanings in a number of different domains, but a couple I want to flag up was that people didn't like the idea that if you have to wear a cycle and high-vis clothes and everything else, they didn't like the hassle of that. Women in particular didn't like the visibility of being a cyclist. If you walk into the office with your helmet and your gear and your towel for your shower, it's kind of a visibility that people don't like. Whereas nobody says, oh, you're a bus traveller or you're a car driver, but they do go, oh, you're a cyclist. So that visibility was a problem. But the largest problem for many women, and particularly women from some minority ethnic groups, was the idea of assertiveness. That if you go on a training course to learn to cycle in London, what they plug and plug and plug is you have to be assertive. You need to cycle in the middle of the road. You have to be assertive. You have to show the other car drivers you're here. You have to be assertive. And this is plugged and plugged and plugged. But what it gets read as is aggressive. And that's a kind of mode that just doesn't resonate with certainly many women, and certainly many women we talk to from minority ethnic groups, who talked about kind of not wanting to get caught up in that aggression that they said you had to have, that it might be contagious. It's not just maybe that you're not just cycling like that, but then you start to be that person. It can be quite contagious. So if I just leave that there a minute, that's just the backdrop for my third case study, which is looking at what cycle hire schemes do to that. Now, if risk is a problem for people taking up cycling, not because they're worried so much about being hurt, but because it is just inherently risky, and that cycling is seen as risky because of that range of high-vis, helmets, all the rest that you need, then one might argue that normalising cycling in the way that the last case study talked about normalising bus travel might make more people take it up. So one of the things we were interested in is what happened if you expand a hire bike scheme, which is what's happened in London. So we just did an observational study looking at who was cycling. And we can't look at kind of, it's quite hard to tell when people are zipping past what their gender and ethnicity is, so we didn't try and count that. But we could count whether they were wearing helmets, high-vis clothes and sporty clothes. And what we found, not surprisingly, was that users of hire bikes in central London very, very infrequently wear helmets, high-visibility clothes and sporty cycling. And that this may well have an impact on normalising the image of cycling, encouraging cycling, making it look like just a you just hop on a bike and go, rather than something you have to get all prepared for. And that might well equalise it. Now, I want to flag this because there have been a couple of studies that have picked up the lack of helmet use on hire bikes as a problem, because it's pushed up head injury. This is, I think, brings me to my final point. That's a real problem. If we're just looking at one outcome, head injury, I'm not even quite convinced by any of the data that has been shown, then we might end up thinking that's a bad thing for public health. If we take a much broader view and look at transport inclusion, look at all of the other well-being outcomes that accrue from cycling, and look at how that's equalising access to cycling, we might end up saying, well, actually, maybe it's a good thing. So if I want to just conclude by saying, well, how can we kind of pull out what works and why, and what are the implications for that? I think I've suggested that going upstream is more likely, perhaps, to deliver a win-win. The problem is going upstream is much more difficult to evaluate. We're so used to in public health trying to have experimental designs that focus on one outcome and one input, helmets, road, head injury. So my implications for research are what we need is research designs that really do address this fact that health is multiple and transport interventions are going to have multiple outcomes, and it's inappropriate just to focus on single things. That we consider the whole system and that we do include some qualitative work that looks at at the meanings of transport systems. And my final implications for practice are that I've talked about three case studies, all from London, which has got a citywide transport governance system. So I don't know what happens when you don't have that. But also, just to say, public health gain is largely delivered outside the health sector, not surprisingly. This is delivered by transport planners. So we need to, as public health practitioners, work with a bit more humility, I think, with some of those planners. And we need to advocate, finally, for including the health gains and losses in evaluations that we do of transport interventions. Thank you.